The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Back now from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and on our way, David, to Minneapolis, Austin, Chicago, New Orleans. This is just sort of one of those dip into the studio, do a quick recording, and go back out. But we had a great time in Coeur d'Alene.
Yeah, the rest of the month we're going to be on the road and traveling, and some of our interviews will be on the road as well, ending with about a week's stint in Shanghai. And now I'm arm wrestling with Don to see if he'll join me in Shanghai for that week. Some very interesting things happening with the Shanghai Gold Exchange.
I was going to say you're a guest of the Shanghai Gold Exchange. Is that not right?
That's correct. Yeah. And the China National Gold Corporation. And as they continue to very quietly accumulate ounces, we see what has been a long-term trend since the 80s and 90s, where the East has played a more dominant role in the physical markets. Now it is a defining, not just a dominant, but a defining role in the physical metals markets.
Well, you're talking about an exchange that sees more than 1,000 tons of gold delivered this year through its exchange. That's incredible. That's an exchange that really didn't play a big role, what, 5-10 years ago.
Yeah, and as we mentioned, we have the November 8th to the 14th meeting. This is the third plenum session of the Chinese Communist Party, in which they'll be laying out the specific strategy. Hopefully the framework will be well detailed so that we understand what steps they're going to take to be transitioning towards an internally consumptive economy. Bottom line for us, of course, is to the degree that they're not running trade surpluses, there is no recycling of those surplus dollars into the U.S. Treasury market. We lose, in that sense, a major prop for our Treasury market. And it requires that we're either not running a deficit anymore, this is a spending deficit, or that the Fed is required to monetize that much more, $100, $200, $300 billion more than they're already doing through what is euphemistically known as quantitative easing.
Well, and this is, we cannot overstate how incredible a change that really is. The symbiotic relationship between ourselves and China for the last 30 or 40 years has been we run a deficit with them, they take those surplus dollars and bring them right back to us. Now, we're seeing them purchasing gold, we're seeing them move to an internally consumptive economy like you're saying. Let's go to gold for a moment.
Well, and before we do, I think this is where we really have lost where the Treasury just doesn't even get this. The relationship between surplus and deficit countries, they are this very week criticizing China and Germany for running account imbalances. In other words, they're saying, you know, listen, these huge surpluses, you shouldn't be running. It's very destabilizing to the world economy.
Why don't you deficit spend like we do?
The problem is, it's two sides to the same coin. We run a deficit, they naturally run a trade surplus. And right. So to be critical of their surpluses is naturally to look at what we're doing in the creation process. We're part and parcel to these surpluses that are being created elsewhere. And of course, you look at peripheral Europe, and the same thing. You have deficit countries and surplus countries. Germany happens to be running a surplus. Well, there's not a huge pat on the back for the Germans just because they're running a trade surplus. That requires deficits on the other side. It's an accounting equation, like two sides of an algebraic equation. One needs the other, otherwise it's incomplete. And so this is, I think, what's fascinating. Bloomberg this morning is talking about the U.S. Treasury and how they're criticizing China and Germany over their trade surpluses. They don't realize that we're part and parcel to the equation.
Well, Dave, the bottom line is they just don't get it. But one thing they do get is the gold. The gold is being transferred from the West to the East. It's such a large percentage right now of world demand that it can't be ignored. So let's look at the gold markets. And I'm not talking necessarily the price, even though the price has been interesting over the last week or so. You know, if you look, we talked about a point and figure chart a couple of weeks ago. And gold has broken to the upside on the point and figure chart. Doesn't mean it can't still fall. But it is an interesting change in the trend that we haven't seen in several years.
Well, it's interesting that the Reserve Bank of India released a report basically saying, okay, demand for gold appears to be autonomous, a function of several influences and factors in India. They go on to say the supply of gold, through organized channels can be constricted, but buyers may take recourse to unauthorized channels to buy gold.
Oh, sure, Pakistan. I mean, look at Pakistani numbers.
And this is what is in sort of the DNA of someone who is a culture that is oriented towards hard work and savings. You don't trust your savings to a central banker. Those are lessons that are learned the hard way in other parts of the world, and they're lessons that still have to be learned in our own culture. We've had the benefit of low rates of inflation for a long, long period of time, nothing that would be sort of hair-raising, an 8, 10, 12, 15, 20% rate of inflation, which is what they deal with quite a bit in Asia from time to time, not year in and year out, but often enough that they say, I never met a central banker I fully trusted.
Well,
isn't that an interesting attitude?
And why would you trust them, Dave? I was at a local bookstore this weekend, and I see that Alan Greenspan has a new book out. It's called The Map and the Territory. And I flipped it over and looked at the back, and it said, you know, why I missed the crash of 2008. It said, no one with any meaningful role in economic decision-making in the world saw beforehand the storm that was coming.
And Kevin, that's
ridiculous.
Not an excuse. That's an indictment. That just says that their models are so blinding that they have an inability to deal with what a man on the street is able to say. Hey, wait a minute, I think asset prices are moving up too quickly. I think home prices going up at a 12% rate year in, year out. I can't remember any time in my lifetime that that's happened. There's a number of things that are just very common sense that the average American would say, yeah, I put my finger to the wind, and I kind of understand which way it's blowing. I kind of get what is happening here. It doesn't take a PhD to get it. In fact, the only ones who missed it, what he's basically indicting, is a whole cadre of PhDs. If you have a PhD, you have a new endemic blindness. You know what it is? It's too much information in your head to make sense of the world as it is.
Well, and you know, it's obvious that they're not subscribers to the McIlvaney Intelligence Advisor, because Don was talking about it for a few years. You were talking about it. Even the commentary, we were talking about it as it was falling apart. Or before it fell apart. Well, David, speaking of not trusting central bankers, banks hold gold. They have reserves in gold. You know, we talked about Germany having reserve gold put here in America and asking for it back, and we told them that it would take 7 years just to deliver 300 tons back. But now this is transferring over to Europe, and you've got other countries starting to say, hey, where's our gold, and what have you been doing with it?
Well, it's very interesting to note that central bankers have been frustrated by this dead asset on their balance sheet. They figured that it could be doing something for them. And we began to see a trend in the early to mid 1990s, where out of the blue, a product became available for our company and generally available in the world, these large hoards of old gold coins that were selling near bullion prices.
Right.
So we had tens of thousands, I think actually a couple hundred thousand Swedish 20 kroners.
And our clients now have them in their portfolios.
Finnish 20 markers. I mean, we had these coins that were minted, again, 100 to 150 years ago in mint condition, had never left the central bank, and yet they were now circulating. And the question we had at the time was, how is this possible that central banks would just release them? Well, the beauty is we do now have in retrospect an understanding, a better understanding of how central banks manage their gold. In fact, they don't keep it all on deposit. They lease a good portion of it out. The Finnish this week acknowledged that, and we had the Austrian Central Bank acknowledge that last year, that basically they've turned their gold hoard into a revenue stream by leasing it out for a small percentage fee. Now, what happens to the leased gold? This is really something that will develop over the next 3, 4, 5 years as we see disclosures of an increase in the official gold held by the Chinese Central Bank. The big question will be, how did they acquire so much without moving the price of the metal?
Well, and I think it's interesting too, Dave. You know, if you hold something on paper that says you own gold, it's a whole lot different than buying that Finnish marka and putting it somewhere where no one can ever find it again. That's deliverable gold. Those poor folks who hold paper will find out that they don't have the gold behind it.
Well, and the irony will be when the Swedish and the Finnish and the American public and the Germans and everyone who assumed that they had tons and tons and tons of metal stored, whether it was at Fort Knox or, you know, with the Bank of England, what happens when they ask for it? When they ask for it, as the Germans did, and it turns out that, oh, it has been leased, it has been lent, and it's not immediately available. There will be a recognition in the marketplace, and I think with this recognition, a panic in price and in activity, a flurry for physical metals demand as a consequence of the revelation that central banks have been leasing gold for years, and that is how there has been a massive shift in metals from one central bank to another without a move in price. This will be, I think, one of the great stories of the 21st century, and it will represent a touchstone, if you will, in the bankruptcy of Western countries.
Well, and David, you've talked about how China has been taking in an unusually large amount of physical gold delivery. When you look at what people are doing right now, we've increased our food stamp dependency. They've increased their gold dependency. And so something seems out of whack. Now, this last week, they did cut back the food stamps slightly. So what was it, $5 billion from an $85 billion program?
This is a reminder that the recovery in the U.S. economy, this is very subjective in nature. And this is the National Bureau of Economic Research. We were in 2009 when the National Bureau of Economic Research announced, declared, told the world that we were in recovery, the recession was over. At that point, we had 35 million participants in the food stamp program. Now, fast forward 2009 to the present, we've now been in recovery for a good number of years, and yet the food stamp program has expanded from 35 million participants to 47.7 million.
So we're almost at 50 million food stamp participants, yet we supposedly have been in recovery now for 4 years?
The Heritage Foundation said this. It's important to put the proposed cuts in perspective. That's the $5 billion in cuts out of the $85 billion. Food stamp spending has doubled twice in the last decade or so. They say it doubled prior to the recession between 2000 and 2007. And it doubled again between 2008 and 2012. So again, the Heritage Foundation points out that, you know, $5 billion in cuts, or you know, essentially $40 billion over a 10-year period, would be a 5% cut to a program that has grown by over 200%.
So that puts it in perspective. The cut's not much at all.
It's not much. It's a huge program. And again, what side are you on? The objective nature of the Federal Reserve would say, hey, listen, we're making great progress. We're going to be able to cut QE. And the Treasury would say, we see signs of recovery. You remember, even back in 2009, the language was of green shoots in the economy. And yet, from the subjective side, you know, 12.7 million new participants since the recovery began, since the recession ended. Ask those 12.7 million participants if things have gotten better or worse. Not that that's the sum total of our population, but there is a trend here, and it's very disconnected from the asset appreciation, which has been part and parcel to the QE infusion of capital. $85 billion spent a year to create a ballooning, a wealth effect for the 1%, the 2%, maybe even the 5% in society. But the vast majority of people in the country, A, have seen no benefit, and B, there are many, maybe not the vast majority, but at least 12.7 million who would say they're worse off today than they were 5 years ago.
So what you're saying is quantitative easing is just really, it's life support for a dying economy. Now, the dollar, you would think with the $85 billion a month that's being printed, you would think that the dollar would break below that technical, you know, support level that it's been on, but it bounced last week.
I feel like this is a conversation we've either had on air or had in the office, which is, you know, listen, if they don't hold the line at 79, we're going to find ourselves in a very desperate circumstance, and by any means necessary, if I had to play the part of the Fed or the Treasury, you look at this and say it must be defended. You fight and die on this particular point. The dollar must not go below 79. And lo and behold, we have seen it rebound. We're now in the low 80s, but where does it go from here? 81, 82? Frankly, it could be over before it begins. It would take a terribly hawkish comment from the Fed to jumpstart a dollar rally of size. You know, barring that, we do see the dollar's half-life is limited. We do see the trend is down, and we do see that level of 79 being retested, and at some point, if not this year, certainly next, broken. But again, we're down to a market which is dependent on what the Fed says. We're always going to encourage you to look at what they're doing more than what they're saying, but the market will move in the short run on the basis of language and language only.
Well, and you notice the language changes. Right as you get near that level, you'll start to hear someone come out, and they're called hawks, okay? And the hawk is somebody who's going to talk about tapering back quantitative easing. Now, we talked with Bill last week, Bill King, and taper's off the table. We all know that, but the talk's not off the table.
Now, there's a couple of things that we will want to talk about, just a review of some of the things we talked about with King, because I think were very important. But we also want to look at sort of the distortion of incentives. This is sort of short-term thinking in corporate America, major increases in share buybacks, in what has been called a bonus culture by Andrew Smithers. And next week, Andrew's going to be a guest on the program. But, you know, here we are looking at Wall Street analysts who think that the world is coming up roses, tulips, maybe dahlias, whatever, pick your favorite flower. And it's not that they're 100% bullish, but what is interesting is that nearly 100% of analysts are bullish. So 41% today would put a buy recommendation on the stock market. 24% would put a strong buy on the stock market. About 28% would say, we're neutral, hold, which is not a sell, it's just hold.
So you put those together, you're talking over 90%, or they're saying
close
they're buy or hold.
Close to 95% are positive to neutral, 5% are suggesting a sell. I mean, give it a few months, and what you may witness for the first time in market history is where the sell category is no longer even needed.
Everybody's 100% bullish.
Right, well, and analysts are missing a few terribly important points. You've got 4% that are in the underperform category, because remember, selling, putting a sell recommendation puts a firm at risk of lawsuit because they're making a proclamation, an objective proclamation, that that stock they think will go down and therefore you should sell. So they changed the language on that. Now it's called underperform. Hmm. So you have 4% of analysts which suggest underperform, and that leaves just 1% with a strong sell category. This is complements of cross currents, these numbers. You know, this week and next, we want to explore a number of different issues that play into the equity market and how management seems to be moving the ball down the field. And analysts are having a heyday with it. Analysts look at this and just can't get enough. They would be only too eager to say, we've got an all-clear signal, the economy is on the move higher, the stock market's on the move higher, you need an all-in bet on equities.
Well, strangely enough, the equities market is rising, yet you still see the insider selling, the executives selling more than they're buying.
Yeah, so corporate insider selling's not at record highs, but they are progressively increasing. From the June statistics, from the beginning of the year statistics, what we have now, you know, and it's particularly strong among sort of the trading sardines, the Wall Street darlings, if you will. So a lot of your technology shares are in that mix.
Google, Amazon,
Facebook,
Cisco, yeah.
Intel, Qualcomm, half a dozen other giants. You know, the current numbers, again, are not as shocking as they have been in the past, but are still fairly sizable. 387 liquidations for every one purchase. 387 to 1, that's still a very strong ratio. Or in terms of shares, you're talking about one share bought for every 6,429 shares sold. And that does not include the very large and automatic sales from Apple. Again, close to 6,500 shares liquidated for every one sold. That's the sentiment indicator you get from corporate chiefs, CIOs, COOs, board members, those who are in charge of sort of scoping out the future for an enterprise, and they're aggressively selling. Have been for 18 months. With higher prices in equities, it's gotten more and more aggressive, and it's just something to keep in mind.
Well, and this is the strange thing, Dave. That's when you look at the individual, you say, okay, what is the executive doing? He's selling. But then you look at the company decisions that these executives are helping to guide, and actually a lot of companies right now are taking shares off of the market. They're buying themselves up rather than investing in long-term plant and equipment. They're actually just investing in their shares and reducing the amount of shares in the market.
Well, next week I want to explore this idea of executive and management compensation with a British economist. He lives in the UK, Andrew Smithers. He's argued that public companies in the US and the UK are purposely managed for the short-term benefit of the operators of the business, and with less and less thought given to real long-term viability in competitive market share. Current investment in plant and equipment is the lowest it's been in the post-war period. And this is what's quite interesting. You've got profit margins, which are at their highest recorded levels ever. And money is being aggressively deployed to buy back shares, and again, at a rate and at a level that is at all-time highs.
So let's just explain for a moment. You have a certain amount of money in a corporation. You can either invest in the long run, buy plant and equipment, and continue that expansion, or you can come in and buy up your own shares off of the market. And what that does is that reduces the amount of shares for the public, but it creates much more equity in the company itself.
Well, and what Smithers describes as a bonus culture, where an increase in the volatility of profits plays out very well for management come bonus time. You know, even if you see volatility in profits to the downside, your increase from 1 year to the next will justify a sizable bonus. But those share buybacks have become a primary means of boosting earnings per share. And this does also factor into sort of how executives are compensated. It used to be a fairly standard to have a decent sized salary and a decent sized bonus. Now you've seen an increase not only in salaries, but an exponential increase in bonuses, those bonuses tied to short-term performance variables.
So what you're taking is you're taking shares off of the market and you're creating fewer, so the earnings per share is going to be divided by fewer shares.
That's exactly right. Total earnings divided by fewer number of shares, that increases your earnings per shares, and delivering the numbers that in turn deliver larger bonuses.
Sure.
So, yeah, some of Smithers' numbers are frightening, comparing the current levels of share buybacks to investment in plant and equipment. I mean, just as an example, he cites, you know, Q2, that is second quarter and third quarter of 2012. Buybacks then and now are about $400 billion a year. So if you're looking at sort of the run rate, $400 billion a year. Companies are today the largest investors in the marketplace for their own shares. We're not talking about, you know, going out and buying at the competition. We're not talking about, again, sort of increasing capacity. There is no real investment in plant and infrastructure today. They're shrinking the number of shares outstanding, hitting the number, playing the Wall Street game, and being able to thereby get their big bonuses. So again, if you don't appreciate how executive compensation works, you might think that it's the best thing going. Look at this. We have a great franchise and we want to own more of it. Well, if that were the case, executives wouldn't at the same time be liquidating shares, their own shares, at breakneck speed.
This is what breaks the whole mechanism of this Keynesian phenomenon that the Fed and the Treasury are trying to put forth. You know, they're quantitatively easing and printing a lot of money. It's going into the stock market. It is not going into reinvestment or investment into the future. And so, you know, Bill King talked about this. You've talked about this. The mechanism is broken. The money's being printed, but it's not getting into anything that creates economic growth.
Well, and Keynes did think that you should step in, and if there was a major drop in the economy, a drop in quote-unquote aggregate demand, then that's where you had government deficit spending. That was supposed to step in, fill the gap until you had a new source of demand or the old source reemerge, and that would either be business spending or consumption. That would be household consumption. And at this point in the game, the Fed and the Treasury are very disappointed with corporate America.
Right.
Because you've got all of these vast cash hoards which should be rolling into the economy via investment, and instead the trend has been to use low interest rates and cheaply borrowed dollars, which again the Fed and the Treasury have delivered up, for the purpose of retiring shares, shrinking the number of shares outstanding, improving earnings per share in that game of meeting and beating Wall Street's quarterly expectations. When the stock rises, that allows for stock compensation packages to improve, bonuses expand, you've got the multiple of the base salary. And again, this is an amazing game. It was just redesigned in the last 15, 20 years, and the unfortunate coincidence is that it is increasing management turnover. Nobody wants to stay at a company very long. They want to get what they can while they can.
Sure, you boost the bonus and then you leave.
Yep. So you've shrunk the time frame for deliverable goals, again, what Smithers calls the bonus culture. And there are other issues we want to explore with Andrew next week. I've read Andrew for years, 12 to 15 at least, and I've found him to be an excellent thinker, an excellent analyst, without an axe to grind.
Well, you know, we've talked about the Q ratio. He wrote a book about that back in 2000.
I would say he wrote the book. I mean, no, so Tobin's Q, you know, this is coming from a Nobel Prize winning economist. That's where Tobin's Q came from. But in terms of taking the idea and really translating it for a modern working era, he wrote the book on the Q ratio back in 2000. He argued that equities had never been so overvalued and were likely to fall severely. Frankly, on that same measure, using Q today, we talked about this before, particularly helpful today because it's consistent. In history, there is this mean reversion. It goes to overvaluation, then it goes to undervaluation, back to overvaluation, back to undervaluation, and it moves back and forth above and below a mean. And he would argue that today we're 65% overvalued in the equity markets. He rang the bell in 2000. He called it. He said, we're too expensive. Stocks have to go down. This is absurd. And lo and behold, we are 65% overvalued today in the equity markets. We're not quite to the extremes seen in 1929 or in 1999 using the Q ratio or Tobin's Q, but we are on a par with where the market was in 1906, in 1937, 1968. 1968 was probably the bear market most similar to the one that we're in now. 1968 to 1982, in nominal terms, you didn't see much of a boost, or much of a decline, rather, in equity prices. They just moved sideways for over a decade.
Well, and
but as you factored in inflation, that's where it was one of the worst bear markets we had ever had, that 68 to 82 period. So again, we're on par with 1906, 1937, and what we went into, the bear market of 68 to 82.
Well, the theory of Keynes, John Maynard Keynes, and you know, we bash him a lot because it doesn't seem to be working, but Keynes did say that if you come in and stimulate the market and it turns into growth, it can be sort of an emergency procedure and then you dip back out. Bill King talked about that last week. But you know, you look at Britain, you look at the United States, you look at Japan. Smithers talks about them and you know, he calls them the Keynesian trio and he says it's not working anymore. It's just not stimulating the system.
Well, and this is central to his argument. We'll unpack this next week. He argues that policymakers have confused a massive structural concern with a short-term cyclical issue. And thus you have central bank and fiscal policies that are aimed at the wrong target to begin with. They're not generating the expected growth in the economy. They're not bringing jobs back into the equation. We have a quote-unquote jobless recovery. And he does say, the UK, US, Japan, they're maxed out. They've done all that they can do in terms of deficit spending. And from this point forward, if they continue on that vein, inflation is inevitable. Now he says there are other parts of the world where you haven't been running the same kind of deficits as these three have. And perhaps they could run some deficits and, again, sort of substitute for the demand that the global economy is so lacking as a stopgap measure. Eventually, we have to still ask the question, are we simply trying to recreate the bubble period of the 2000s, you know, where we saw growth on steroids because of the amount of debt in the system, because of the expansion of off-balance sheet liabilities in the banking sector, shadow banking, if you will, expansion in the derivatives market, you know, the financialization of products. This is what we had in terms of the alchemy of finance where, you know, again, every bank was slicing and dicing and taking one product, turning it into 10 products, charging fees for the 10 products, even though you only had one underlying asset in question. All those games, is that really what we want to go back to? Is that what we're holding out for, is just a return?
Well, Tobin's Q may be one way of measuring whether you're overvalued on the stock market, but something even less complex than that is just looking at margin debt. Right now, stacking is what people are doing. They're saying, okay, well, with a dollar, I want to buy $10 worth of stocks because it's not going down.
It's as good as it gets. We've gotten it all clear from the Fed. We know that it's only up from here. You listen to Wall Street, and it's only strong prognostication. Well, there are a few more in the audience that are noticing that margin debt has breached all-time highs and beginning to see a few more articles in the mainstream media on that. And not only has it reached all-time highs, breached the all-time highs, as a percentage of stock market capitalization, you now have more margin debt, again, relative to the total size of the stock market, than we had. It has now eclipsed the runaway speculative market of 1929.
So it's higher than the 1929 crash year.
Yeah. Well, and Alan Newman points out that there's nothing in the margin stats that help us precisely to predict a market top. But he reflects on the three previous peaks, followed successively by, well, back in 1929, a 90%, let's call it 89 to be precise, percent decline. And then more recently, a 50% decline. And then most recently, here within the last decade, another 50% decline in equities.
But maybe it's different this time, Dave. I mean, maybe this time we're going to get away with this margin debt and not have the crash that this always has predicted in the past.
One thing that you can't predict is how insane markets can become and how irrational investors can become. And so, well, perhaps the Fed is distorting the picture beyond what most of us have an imagination for. I would agree with you. We aren't going to see it different this time. But the danger of Fed activity today is that they're experimenting with monetary policies that have never before been implemented on this kind of a scale. The consequence has been to inflate asset prices. And if they should fall, this is the real issue, if you set asset prices on such a high perch, when they fall farther than they would have otherwise. The issue, the core issue there is that because you've combined this backdrop of indebtedness, again, household indebtedness, corporate indebtedness, at the national level, indebtedness, when you have a collapse in asset prices, you're inviting a depression, not a recession, into the picture. So debt is that backdrop issue. A fall in the price of assets, it causes hemorrhaging in the debt markets with a knock-on effect felt in the banking and financial community as a result of having leveraged balance sheets. So again, you've got the financial industry, which has all this leverage, and the debt that's backing it, all of a sudden a decline in asset prices, and what may have felt good on the way up, a double dose leverage again helps increase your profitability and your returns, but it's a double dose of punishment. It hurts. It's painful on the way down.
Well, and that takes us to something that Bill King talked about last week. He talked about a chart formation called a rising wedge. He even said you can Google it and see that that's always an indication that you're going to either have a major breakdown, but it can also indicate that you're going to have a major break to the upside. Now,
yeah,
with
we were
the
talking
stock
about
market,
the chart of the S&P 500.
Yeah, yeah.
And classically, it is resolved with either a major move, typically lower, but, you know, with Fed interventionism at record levels, you could also see a breakout in the other direction.
Free money.
Yeah, and we're not talking about a mild-mannered sort of gradual step higher. We're talking about a short covering generated jump to record highs. And keep in mind, that's not really the recipe for sustainable growth in an equity portfolio. More in keeping with sort of a last gasp and the placing of a high watermark. Well, that would likely be remembered as sort of a manic peak. Our opinion? Consistent with Bill's last week, the odds favor a move lower, with volumes being one indicator, volumes of shares traded in the New York Stock Exchange continuing to decline. You realize, Kevin, that over the last decade, we've seen volumes decline on the New York Stock Exchange by between 50 and 60%.
I
mean, off of their peaks. They accelerated into 2006 and 7 and 8, and off of those peaks, we are now at the same levels that we were circa 2000, 2001.
And this is including the high-frequency traders and a lot of the shares that are being traded just by computer.
Well, right. And then that's where the majority of volume is coming from. 60 to 70% of existing volume is not from individuals buying mutual funds or buying individual shares. It is algorithm traders. It is Wall Street trading their own book. Not your money, their money. And it's just, it's interesting. Yeah. The decline in volumes, that is to us a real telltale. When this market turns and rolls over, it's going to be ugly. The Fed's footprint, that is the major footprint in the market. And you know, we did talk about the S&P 500. Well, compare the S&P 500. That chart, and if you were to overlay a chart of the Fed's SOMA, that's the ironic, the acronym for the System Open Market Account. This is not a drug that you get to keep your mind numb, as we found in A Brave New World. Now, the Fed actually has this thing called SOMA, the System Open Market Account. If you overlay that with the equity market, the S&P 500, you observe that Fed activity begets market activity. And when the Fed pauses for any time at all, so does the market. So, I mean, we're in this strange environment. Stocks are dependent on the ebullient sentiment generated by QE. To the degree that QE is in motion, the stock market's in motion. If it pauses, the market pauses, even declines. This is sort of the catch-22 that we're in. Where and when do you take the hit? The Fed has to decide. If they do taper, you understand that the market has grown grossly dependent on what the Fed is doing in the economy.
Well, and Bill King pointed out that Janet Yellen is so easy looking as far as the way she's from her past speeches.
Easy looking, not easy on the eyes. That's not what she meant, I don't think.
Easy from an expansionary monetary point of view, that she may have to pull sort of a miniature Volcker event just to try to get the market's attention. Now, that puts danger in the market as well, because just as soon as you start to assume too much of any one thing, the market's going to show you something different.
Bill points out two things this week. And he says, yep, these are bell ringers. If you look at the financials ETF, if you look at how the financials are trading, and look at the Russell 2000, both of an even broader cross-section of stocks than the S&P 500, both of these sectors, if you will, or cross-sections of the financial world, they're diverging from the S&P.
They're starting to fall.
They're moving lower while the S&P is still moving higher. That, to him, is a warning sign. Couple this with the divergence between high-yield bonds, where they're moving lower, and the S&P is still moving higher. These, you have telltales which indicate money is becoming more risk-averse and taking profits, even as the indexes draw the public in and the mass media continues to sort of sound the drumbeat. Here's how you make money in the market. Just put more money to work. You were only so foolish to have it all sitting in cash all these months and years. There is sort of a sucker attraction at these prices because it seems inevitable. Tomorrow is only going to be as good as yesterday was, and I'm just so regretful that I didn't participate. And again, this is where the public comes in and proves themselves the sucker. You have higher nominal prices. Why I mentioned the 68 to 82 period, that bear market is like the bear market we have today. We had, in nominal terms, the market was doing fine between 1968 and 82. There was volatility. It went up and it went down and it went up and it went down. But over the years, from 68 to 82, it really did nothing. You didn't lose ground. You didn't gain ground. It wasn't that bad of a picture. When you factored inflation into the equation, that's when you found yourself with greater than a 50, 60% loss being an equity owner. And that is what we see transpiring today. If you look at the S&P 500, let's be generous and pick the index, which has put in new all-time highs. If you price it in real terms, that is, factor in inflation over the last decade, you still see a chart that is in decline. It is decaying. And just like that 68 to 82 period, inflation accelerates at the tail end and caps what is a decade or two of utter disaster.
Well, and we've talked about the gold to Dow ratio, and David, during that same period of time, from 1966 at least until 1980, we saw the Dow worth 30 ounces of gold in 1966 move all the way down to 1 ounce of gold in 1980.
And it only gave you one opportunity. If you missed the beginning of the trend and you didn't buy gold at $35 an ounce, my dad did, many of our listeners did as well. If you weren't so lucky as to buy gold at $35, $35, $40, $50, $60, $70 an ounce, the market gave you one opportunity, one double take, and that was 1976. You had gone up over 460%, and the market retraced 50%. It dropped from 192 down to just below $100 an ounce. That was your last opportunity before all of those major trends worked their way through the marketplace. Equities took it on the chin in real and nominal terms, and gold had its move from, again, let's call it 102 up to 875. That was the final move of the bull market in metals. Then what does that look like fast forward to the present? The transition year, like 76, was likely 2013. 2014 to 2018, this is a time frame in which we see sort of the final moves of many of these markets, whether it is a major reversion to the mean in the bond market, where interest rates move higher, bond prices move lower. The dollar takes that step low, the 79 level, and goes into the next phase of bear territory on the dollar-euro index. Gold moving into its next and final move higher. Again, short-term progress has to be made. Gold has to get above 1430, 1540, 1700, 1900, these incremental steps, but then breaking into new territory. I would argue that this is where, ironically, even though I would encourage you to be adding ounces today, you need to be thinking in terms of an exit strategy. When you buy something, you need to know what to do with it, how and when to dispose of it. I would confidently be adding ounces at these levels, but with an idea that what happens over the next months to years will happen on an accelerated basis, not unlike what we saw in the 1970s. Inflation is of that nature. You go from zero expectations to the expectation of inflation, feeding on and multiplying the concerns and becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy, leading to even greater rates of inflation. Again, the argument we have to dissect with Andrew Smithers this next week is how do we, the Keynesian trio, step back from deficit spending, which if we continue on this course will lead to inflation, and will anyone else step up to the plate to do the same? Is that a long-term workable solution? In our opinion, no, but it may buy enough time for other elements in the global economy to recover.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Be sure to join us next week when we'll be interviewing Andrew Smithers. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.